So how much do you trust, like, the digital foundations you rely on every single day? I mean, if a system has been running perfectly for a decade, no crashes, no strange errors, no latency spikes, you probably just assume it's secure, right?
Right. Yeah. We definitely have this built-in bias.
Yeah, we equate longevity with safety. Like, if a bridge hasn't collapsed in 10 years, we just assume it's structurally sound.
Which is actually a really dangerous cognitive trap in cybersecurity. I mean, physical materials degrade in very obvious ways, rust, cracks, but code is static.
Yeah, the code itself doesn't rust.
Exactly. The environment around the code evolves, the threat landscape shifts, but these legacy systems that we build our entire digital lives on, they often just remain frozen in time. So the age of a system is actually this massive liability, and we are seeing the consequences of that blind trust unraveling in real time right now.
And that concept of legacy and, the hidden liabilities buried inside it, that is exactly what we are unpacking today in this deep dive. We're using sources from June 13th, 2026.
It's a packed stack of sources today, too.
Oh, totally. We are looking at a 10-year-old Chinese espionage operation that just got uncovered, a similarly ancient bug in ubiquitous open source software. And this is wild how this whole vulnerability landscape is forcing massive multi-billion dollar shifts in global infrastructure.
Yeah, from server rooms right up to the geopolitical stage.
Exactly. Plus, we're finishing up with the literal rebuilding of a legendary 1998 video game masterpiece. So, lots to cover. But let's start with Velvet Ant, because this completely shatters that illusion of legacy security we were just talking about.
It really does.
This is a Chinese state-sponsored group that remained completely undetected inside the Linux servers of a major East Asian organization for nearly 10 years. They breached the network around 2016.
Yeah, a decade of persistent access. I mean, that is almost unheard of in modern incident response.
It's crazy.
Velvet Ant achieved this by, well, compromising the very mechanisms designed to validate identity. They went straight for the authentication layer, specifically targeting PAM, that's the pluggable authentication module, and OpenSSH.
Wait, so they didn't just steal passwords?
No. They fundamentally altered the trust mechanism of the operating system itself.
I really want to dig into the mechanics of how they pulled that off.
Right.
Because they didn't just, like, brute force their way in. They modified the actual binaries. From what I'm reading here, they hooked into the authentication function within PAM. So before the system even performs the cryptographic hash of a user's password to check if it's valid, the back door intercepts the plain text.
Right. It sits right at the front door.
Yeah. And it looks for a highly specific hard-coded magic string. If the input matches that string, the back door grants immediate root access. It just bypasses the actual authentication entirely.
So wait, altering PAM and OpenSSH, is it basically like replacing the bouncer in an exclusive club with an identical twin who just secretly lets all their friends in through the back door?
That is exactly what it's like.
Yeah.
And the scary part is what happens when someone who actually belongs there tries to get in.
Right, like a normal admin. Exactly. If the input doesn't match the magic string, meaning it's just a regular administrator logging in to do their job, the back door quietly logs that legitimate plaintext password into a hidden file for the attackers to collect later.
Oh, wow.
And then it just passes the credential along to the normal PAM process. The administrator gets in none the wiser.
So the bouncer still does their normal job for regular people,
Yeah.
but steals their ID info while doing it.
Precisely. And Velvet Ant altered just a few hundred bytes of code to accomplish this. Cygnia, which is the Israeli incident response firm that finally caught them, they only detected the breach by hunting down these like microscopic anomalies in the authentication log.
Just tiny discrepancies.
Yeah, they found successful terminal sessions that lacked the corresponding standard session initialization events.
It's an incredible display of strategic patience. I mean, they weren't deploying noisy ransomware or exfiltrating massive databases all at once. They just sat quietly on the network perimeter, skimming credentials and monitoring communications for 10 years.
Which is the definition of a sophisticated surgical espionage operation.
But while Velvet Ant is that high-end surgical strike, the Akito security research on PHPBB that we have in our stack shows that decade-old blind spots can also be shockingly primitive, right?
Oh, the PHPBB vulnerability is the perfect counterpoint. I mean, here we have one of the most widely deployed open source forum platforms on the internet, And Aikido just disclosed a critical flaw in versions 4.0.x and older that had been sitting in the code base since 2014.
Over for a decade.
Yeah, it was only patched on June 12th, 2026. And unlike Velvet Ant, an attacker exploiting this didn't need to rewrite system binaries or, you know, maintain deep persistence.
Right, they just had to send a single HTTP request. The bug involves this catastrophic failure in how PHPBB handled session tokens. Essentially, the server was failing to properly cryptographically validate the session ID being passed in the header.
Which is a huge oversight.
Right. So an attacker could craft a specific HTTP request, inject their own parameters, and the server would just accept it as a valid, authenticated administrator session. You don't need a password. You don't need a phishing campaign to steal an admin's token.
Going back to your bouncer analogy.
Yeah, you effectively print your own VIP wristband, hand it to the bouncer, and the bouncer just waves you into the VIP section without even checking the watermark.
Exactly. And the paradox here is really striking. Because the authentication layers, whether it's PAM on a Linux server or session management in a web application, they are single points of failure. When they break, the entire defense-in-depth model just collapses.
Because you've trusted the checkpoint too much.
Exactly. It really underscores why an assume breach mentality is absolutely non-negotiable for anyone managing infrastructure today. You have to assume the perimeter authentication can and will be bypassed, which is why zero trust architectures and really rigorous internal segmentation are standard practice now. Relying just on passwords, even complex ones, it's just not enough anymore.
Multi-factor authentication is the bare minimum now for you at home, really. But, you know, we spend all this energy agonizing over technical authentication, locking down session tokens and PAM binaries. But then you look at what happened in Maine this week, and the entire concept of authentication was just thrown out the window by legislative design.
Oh, this story is wild.
The Maine Attorney General's data breach reporting portal had to be completely taken offline on Juneteenth because it basically became a localized engine for disinformation.
Yeah, so to give some context, this portal exists because of state laws requiring companies to publicly disclose data breaches. It's meant to protect consumers, right? Through transparency.
Right, good intentions.
Exactly. But on June 9th, two massive breach reports appeared on the live site. One claimed Discord had suffered an insider threat exposing 10 million users.
Huge news, if true.
Right. And the other claimed VRChat had 2.4 million users compromised.
And neither of them were real. VRChat's head of community, Charles Tupper, he had to scramble to put out a public denial, pointing out that the employee name attached to the official state filing was completely fabricated.
Because the fundamental flaw here was that the state portal operated on a post-publication review model.
Which means what, exactly?
It means the HTTP POST request from the submission web form just populated the database and pushed the entry directly to the live public-facing website immediately.
Wait, so anyone could just type a fake corporate disaster into an official government website without so much as verifying an email address?
Literally anyone. There was no middleware verifying the origin domain of the submitter's email address, let alone any rigorous identity verification. They engineered a system based entirely on good faith.
Doesn't transparency actually become a weapon here?
That is exactly what happens. It's a fascinating vulnerability because it's not a buffer overflow or a cryptographic failure. You know, it's a structural logic flaw in government transparency. Threat actors understand that a .gov domain carries immense algorithmic and social authority.
It's weaponizing the trust infrastructure.
Exactly. You push a fake breach to an official state site, automated news scrapers and algorithmic trading bots pick it up immediately, and you can cause a massive reputational crisis. Or, you know, even move a stock price before a human at the Attorney General's office even has time to get their morning coffee and validate the submission.
That is terrifying. In modern information warfare, transparency without verification is basically just an unauthenticated write API for bad actors.
Yeah. And manipulating that public trust, combined with the technical vulnerabilities we discussed earlier, well, that forms the exact ecosystem that modern extortion syndicates rely on to generate billions in revenue.
Which brings us to the Conti ransomware network. So Alexei Litvinenko, Ukrainian national, just pleaded guilty in a Nashville federal court and is facing up to 20 years.
Which is a huge win for law enforcement.
It is. He was actually picked up in Cork, Ireland in 2023 and extradited. But we have to look at the scale of Conti between 2020 and 2022 to really understand the significance of this. They caused over $150 million in damages across more than 1,000 networks.
Incredible scale.
And they achieved that scale because they didn't operate like, you know, a guy in a basement or a traditional hacking group. They operated like a highly structured SaaS company.
Right. The ransomware as a service or RAS model, it relies on a very strict division of labor. The core development team in the syndicate writes the locker malware. They manage the Tor negotiation portals. They maintain the leak sites and handle the cryptographic keys. Basically, they provide the infrastructure.
Separate platform.
Right. And affiliates like Litvinenko, they act as independent contractors.
It's essentially a tech platform taking a massive app store cut, or like a twisted fast food franchise. The developers are corporate, providing the secret sauce. And Litvinenko is the local franchise kicking up, what, 70% of the profits?
Exactly. The affiliate handles the actual network penetration, the lateral movement, and deploying the locker. If they secure a ransom payment, the smart contract or payment processor automatically splits the cryptocurrency. Litvinenko would keep his 20 to 30%, and the rest gets kicked up to corporate.
It's so professionalized.
It really is. And the operational brilliance, and frankly, the cruelty of Conti, was their mastery of double extortion. They realized that network backups were becoming too reliable. I mean, if a hospital can just wipe their servers and restore from an offline tape drive, the decryption key is worthless.
Right. The victim has no incentive to pay.
Exactly. So the affiliates prioritize data exfiltration before triggering the encryption routine.
Ah. So you lock the files, but you also hold terabytes of sensitive data hostage.
Patient records, private emails, intellectual property.
Wow. So even if you can restore your network in an hour, they threaten to dump your unencrypted files on the dark web if you don't pay. It makes the technical recovery irrelevant because it becomes a PR and regulatory crisis.
Double extortion.
But, you know, the most interesting part of the Conti story isn't their malware. It's how the entire syndicate imploded. It wasn't an Interpol sting or a zero-day exploit against their servers.
No, it was internal human betrayal. Ideological fracturing, really. Geopolitics shattered their digital borders. In February 2022, immediately following the invasion of Ukraine, Conti's core leadership posted a message on their site declaring full support for the Russian government.
Which was a catastrophic failure in reading the room. I mean, their affiliate network was heavily staffed by Ukrainian developers and hackers.
Exactly. And an enraged Ukrainian member of the syndicate retaliated by dumping 170,000 internal Jabber chat messages, source code, and affiliate panels straight onto the public internet.
The famous Conti leaks.
Right. It completely dismantled their operational security. It gave global law enforcement the exact roadmap needed to unmask operators like Litvinenko.
Poetic justice, really. But what is the takeaway for you listening if you are defending enterprise networks?
The critical lesson is that paying the ransom is a strategic failure. It just directly funds the RAS development cycle. The only mathematically sound defense against double extortion is rigorous network segmentation to slow down that lateral movement, combined with immutable air-gapped backups.
Keep it offline.
Exactly.
Well, the borderless nature of threats like Velvet Ant and Conti is exactly why we are seeing a massive multi-billion dollar panic at the nation-state level to localize critical infrastructure.
Oh, totally.
Which completely recontextualizes our sources on Mistral AI. This French startup is currently in talks to raise 3 billion euros at a 20 billion euro valuation. This is their Series D funding. And they were only founded in 2023 by former researchers from DeepMind and Meta.
They're scaling at an unprecedented rate. And they're backed by the French government alongside U.S. giants like Microsoft and heavily capitalized VC firms like A16Z. But, you know, their valuation isn't just about benchmark scores against GPT-4.
What is it about them?
It's rooted in the geopolitical concept of digital sovereignty.
I have to play devil's advocate and challenge the economics of this for a second. We already have American giants like OpenAI, Anthropic, and Google pouring tens of billions of dollars into compute clusters and training runs. Mistral is obviously an incredible engineering team. But why does Europe need to pour 20 billion euros into its own version? Is this just national pride? Like, why not just license the APIs from the U.S.?
It's not just pride. It's about AI as strategic infrastructure. Think of it like historical dependencies on foreign oil. Because of data gravity and strategic reliance, if Every European bank, healthcare provider, and defense contractor embeds an American LLM into their core workflows. They are effectively outsourcing the cognitive layer of their economy.
Oh,
To face digital colonization, they become subject to U.S. export control, Section 702 surveillance risks, and just the whims of a foreign regulatory environment.
And once your enterprise architecture is deeply intertwined with a specific model's API, extracting it is nearly impossible. You're completely locked in.
Exactly, but it goes beyond just where the servers are physically located. Mistral's core value proposition revolves around European data locality and GDPR compliance from the foundation up. You can't train a sovereign model by just indiscriminately scraping the global web.
Right, because of privacy laws.
You have to curate the training data to reflect local privacy laws and cultural frameworks. Models implicitly encode the weighting, biases, and linguistic nuances of their training sets.
That makes total sense. Think about it. Who owns the brain you're asking to write your emails or summarize your documents? And whose cultural values are baked into its responses? If a European government relies entirely on a model optimized by reinforcement learning from human feedback based in Silicon Valley, the outputs will inherently reflect American corporate and cultural norms.
Exactly. Mistral is the blueprint for keeping value creation, data, and cultural alignment regional within European borders.
It's fascinating that Europe is spending billions to build hyper-localized, brand new infrastructure to preserve its regional identity, while simultaneously, the biggest news in gaming right now is all about taking a cultural masterpiece and rebuilding it entirely from scratch to preserve its legacy.
A very different kind of preservation, but yeah.
Exactly. The June 2026 Nintendo Direct just announced a ground-up remake of The Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time for the upcoming Switch 2, launching late this year.
The 1998 original holds a near-mythic status in the industry. It maintains a 99 out of 100 on Metacritic. The technical challenge for the developer, Grezzo, here is monumental, because they aren't just doing a remaster.
And I always get tripped up on the terminology here, so that is a really important technical distinction. A remaster is like taking the original blueprints of a classic 60s sports car and giving it a modern paint job and some cleaner trim, right? The underlying chassis and engine block are exactly the same. But a remake, this is like taking those 1998 blueprints, bulldozing the old building, and rebuilding it with state-of-the-art materials.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Translating the logic of a 1998 Nintendo 64 game into a modern 4K, 60 frames per second engine is notoriously difficult. In early 3D games, physics calculations and collision detection were often hard-coded directly to the frame rate.
Oh, right, because of hardware limitations.
Right, so if you just uncap the frame rate on old code, the game logic completely breaks. Characters move too fast or fall through the floor. So Grezzo has to decouple the original mechanics from the rendering loop, completely rewrite the physics engine, and update the rendering pipeline for a modern architecture. And they have to do all that without losing the tactile feel of the original inputs that fans remember.
Which sounds nearly impossible.
Yeah.
But it's a massive flex for the Switch 2 hardware, proving it can handle that pristine 60p's performance on a portable hybrid device. And I think it also signals this golden age of remakes, where the industry's shifting how it handles preservation. Mm-hmm. It's not just about emulating old ROMs, it's about actively rebuilding the code, so a 15-year-old today can experience the mechanics of Ocarina of Time without fighting archaic camera controls and 20 frame per second limitations.
It perfectly mirrors our entire discussion today, honestly. Code is not static. Whether it's a vulnerable Linux authentication module, a flawed PHP session token, or a legendary video game, legacy code eventually demands a reckoning. You either rebuild it, or you suffer the consequences of ignoring it.
Wow, yeah. We really have covered a massive spectrum today. From Velvet Ant weaponizing trust in PAM to Maine inadvertently creating a disinformation API. We saw the Conti ransomware syndicate collapse under the weight of global geopolitics, Europe's 20 billion euro defense against digital colonization with Mistral, and Link's fully re-engineered return to Hyrule.
It really makes you evaluate our current trajectory. I want to leave everyone with the thought here. We've seen today that legacy code can be a hidden liability or a cultural treasure. We are rushing to integrate these massive sovereign AI models into our workflows, increasingly relying on them to generate and deploy code at scale. So what part of our current cutting-edge digital world will we look back on in 10 years and realize was just highly vulnerable legacy code?
That's a great question.
Especially when the foundational infrastructure of the 2030s might be written by hallucinating AI models. Will we even have human engineers capable of auditing that generated legacy code, or will we be locked into a vulnerable black box of our own making?
A brilliant and, honestly, slightly terrifying thought to end on. You really have to wonder if the Velvet Ant of the 2030s will be hunting for back doors or just politely asking an AI to write them into the code base for them. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. Keep questioning the foundations of the technology you use every day. Assume your perimeter is already breached, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.